Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 1st, 2009, going right into the show, and finally back a little bit to normal. As some of you may know or have heard, as I was a guest on a couple radio shows over the past week, that I had one of my excursions, let's just put it that way. And I'll have more of a report on that in upcoming days, or at least in the next week, probably. But some very interesting things happening in the world today. But this show is going to be part 8, and there was so much information on this topic of the misconceptions regarding Planet X. It started out to be a 3-part series, and now we are on part 8. But I know these are topics that people really are interested in hearing about. I get the feedback from all over the world, of course, and people are very interested in this topic and understanding it, really understanding it, not just the fly-by-night, yeah, there's a Planet X, and actually there's hundreds, there are thousands of them out there, and they have drastically affected the history of this planet that we live on. And it will, they will affect the planet in the future. I'm not sure exactly what the date might be, but there is a very important lesson, a very important central lesson to be learned from all of this. And I will be talking about that central important lesson tonight. And of course, we all think, well, we want to be prepared. We want to have a water filter. We want to have food stored up. But that really isn't the lesson. What is the real lesson regarding these extra solar system objects that come in, wreak havoc with the planetary system, not just Earth, the other planets also, and then leave, or some of them end up staying like Venus. I talked about that last week. I'll have some follow-on comments regarding Venus. But first of all, just a couple quick announcements. I'm going to do this one before I get into the science issues. Remember that there is a federal law, and we all love federal laws, I know that, but it regarding a thing called the Paperwork Reduction Act, and it's a law that was actually brought in during the Reagan administration of all times. And it basically stated, because there were so many forms and so many agencies filing forms and telling you you had to fill out forms, that they started an office called the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, Office of Management and Budget. And basically, any legitimate federal form had to be verified by OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and given a legitimate, valid OMB number. Now, in recent years, and especially with the advent of the flu shot and everybody running around claiming their authority over this and that, and you and your brother and your cousin and your aunt, your uncle, everybody, this idea that there has to be a legitimate OMB number on a form, so if somebody hands you a form and says, well, this is a federal form, you have to do this, you have to respond to it. And some of our most illustrious agencies in this country do not have valid OMB numbers. Now, I'm not going to go into any specific detail here, but you might imagine and well imagine some of the agencies that don't. They are not legitimate agencies of the federal government. They are sending forms to literally everyone, and they don't have a single valid OMB number in their itinerary of forms. So just as you... now, also... to add to the confusion, there are some agencies that in the past have sent out forms and created their own imaginary OMB number to look like a real valid OMB number. So if you get a form and it has an OMB number on it, and it's very clearly written on the top right or the bottom right hand corner, one of the top or bottom corners, it says OMB and then there's a number. You go on to the OMB website, and you can validate if that is a legitimate OMB number or not. So it's very interesting to see that little forms like, oh, I'll just mention one that maybe some of you have seen, the 1040 form, does not have a valid OMB number. Isn't that interesting? So now with the reason I'm mentioning this is with the advent of the swine flu and the government wanting everybody to take it, remember that first of all, for someone to be a legitimate federal agency, they have to have forms that are valid, that possess valid OMB numbers and are listed on the forms. So if anybody walks around, hands you a form or says you have to do this or do that, first of all, they need a form. Second of all, it needs a valid OMB number on it. So look for that. Just a little heads up as I try to always keep you in the know with this show. On to, of course, over the last couple of weeks was a guest on September 21st, the first day of fall, the changing of the seasons. I was a guest on Coast to Coast AM with host George Norrie, talking about the lack of sunspots. The sun, as of today, still has no sunspots. We had one teeny, teeny sunspot cross the disk of the sun over the past week. And the it basically went away. But that was the only sunspot in ages. So we are basically sitting here with no sunspots for well over 2 years. I forget the number of days. Clearly, we're setting unprecedented records in this regard. And so if you want to hear some conversation on that, check out the archive on the Coast to Coast webpage, Monday night, September 21st, Coast to Coast. And there were some very interesting call-in questions at the end of that. Also, on Tuesday this past week, I was a guest with my good friend John Moore on his weekly radio show, and we talked about the incidents, the American Samoan earthquake and resulting tsunami. I'll mention that in a minute. And then also the earthquake in Indonesia followed the next day, the day I did the show with John as a guest. The American Samoa earthquake and tsunami had just occurred, so we didn't have much news, but we talked about that. So at any rate, three big waves of storms hitting the Philippines this past week and Southeast Asia. It was interesting because I just happened to be on the phone with somebody from the Philippines during the first wave of the storms. And it's funny the way they look at these over there. It's a tremendous inundation, of course, high winds, basically a typhoon hit the Philippines, but the comment that the person had was, well, it's sunny now, so we're just back to normal. So in the Philippines, they are used to this. In Indonesia, Melanesia, and through the South Pacific, they get these storms too, not as quite as often, but China, Thailand, Vietnam, all getting hit with these storms during this rainy season, as they call it, the monsoon season. But at any rate, it was interesting to see three waves almost equally spaced hitting those islands, wave after wave of torrential downpours, and then the storms moving inland to the mainland China and the peninsula, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, etc. Now, this is just a heads up, and many radio stations are covering this next topic, so I just want to give you a heads up, but there's a little town called Hardin, Montana. Very interesting story. Just look it up on the internet and you'll have more information than you know what to do with. But H-A-R-D-I-N, Montana. Hardin, Montana. And it's about an outfit called the American Police Force. An alleged company that came allegedly out of California, having ties allegedly to the federal government. And a private police force doing private training of a worldwide police force that has allegedly the ability to mount a battalion to any location in the world within 72 hours, and they are for hire to any foreign government, to anybody who wants to hire their services. So anyway, go and check that out, because I know a lot of the big daytime talk show hosts are talking about that. But if you have not heard about this, make sure you check that out. Just do a Google search or whatever your favorite search engine is. Do a search on Hardin, Montana, or American Police Force. you will get an earful and an eyeful on that one. So at any rate, just a couple other quick topics here. Remember, I know there's every week there's new people listening to this show. So go to my webpage for more information. That's JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com. And all of the times and places this show is aired during the week are listed there. Just a quick summary, it airs, this is the first live airing of the show, 6 p.m. Central Time on WWCR, the powerhouse 400,000 watt four tower station out of Nashville, frequency 5.070 megahertz, heard worldwide, and also they have the internet stream, of course, at www.wwcr.com, and just go to the on listen online in Tower 3. On Friday night, it re-airs and on Tower 4, frequency 5.890 at 10 p.m. and 10 p.m. Friday night and 3 a.m. Saturday morning, and it's also then heard on Galaxy 25. But as I said, you will hear all of this. You can see all of the details on my webpage. And then 2 hours after this show airs live, it also re-airs on RealityRadioNetwork.com, which is strictly a high-quality internet feed. And that, of course, is also available worldwide. So for more details, just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and all of the details of the shows, the times, how to listen, etc., will be listed there. All the details for Galaxy 25 satellite. On to the main science topic. Now, what is the most important aspect of this topic of Planet X? And of course, I guess most of us would reflect back and say, well, how does it affect me and my family, my life, planet Earth, the human race, etc., etc.? So that's exactly what I'm going to be talking about tonight, the influence of this topic on the human race. Now, remember that about 90% of, or to maybe 99% of the human race has never even heard of this topic. But I think the general consensus is that most people kind of have their ears up, like the deer in the forest. They know something is up. They know that information that comes to them from the government sources, from textbooks, from the newspaper, from the evening news, or from whatever source of information they're getting it, that something isn't quite right. Somebody isn't quite telling them the whole story, the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so to speak. And there's a lot of twists and turns. And so I got it was interesting that when I was on the Coast to Coast show with George Norrie, he asked me, he said, Jim, you know, there's a lot of people who take your information and twist it and turn it and try and borrow it and, you know, what do you think about that? What's your take on that? And I said, well, of course, anytime you have good information, there's going to be charlatans out there that try and borrow it or make a quick buck off of it. But I said, I use that as an education tool. There you could attack them on many different levels. You could try legal recourse, which, of course, it would cause expense and time and money and all of those other things. And, of course, then you'd also have to have faith in the American legal system, which, of course, I don't have any faith in. But the other thing is I said that I use it as an education tool because, first of all, these charlatan websites are, first of all, going to fool a lot of people. They're going to be drawn in. They're going to go, oh, these people are really trying to get the word out. They really have this information, and on and on. But what's going to happen eventually is they're going to find out that the people behind the web pages are charlatans. They're imposters, people with no degrees trying to be astrophysicists, for example, or other types of degreed professionals, or claiming, in a lot of cases, to be associated with dead people. You know, once you start to realize this, all of a sudden you go, gee, these people really aren't legit. Everything they're claiming here has a scam, kind of a twist. There's nothing legitimate about what they're doing. They're borrowing material from everybody else, primarily McCanny's work here. So what's the real educational value in that? Well, then you notice that, for example, some of the sites, who is sponsoring them? Remember that when I did earlier shows on the Planet X series, I talked about who butters their bread. You just ask that very simple question. You go to a website, you hear the evening news, you read a newspaper, you read a scientific magazine or a glossy magazine off the shelf dealing with astronomy or space science or science, whatever it is, you ask the question, who butters their bread? You look at a NASA scientist giving a report on TV or to the public or to Congress. You look and ask, who butters their bread? Why are they saying what they're saying? And 99.9999999% of the time, it comes back to one simple thing, money. Who pays them money? Who butters their bread? So then you come back to this question that George Norrie asked me. I said, I use this as educational value, because now you have the public going out there, going to these sites, thinking they're learning something, and the public is thinking they're learning something, but in reality, eventually they wake up and they go, how come every day this website here has a picture that comes directly from NASA? Well, gee, that's pretty interesting. There's a website that claims that they support Velikovsky, but oddly enough, every day they have a picture that comes from NASA, nicely formatted with information about it. Who's really supporting this? So then you find out that these are misinformation sites. So when that light bulb goes on, when that person out there who's new, he's been fooled, now he realizes he's been fooled, that person just got a very valuable piece of education. There's information out there and there's misinformation, and misinformation is very subtle. You have to learn to read it. You have to learn to recognize it. And as I said, who is supporting this? Where does the funding come from? How come these places have a big staff of people that work every day and get paid and have a nice glossy web page that's supported every day? Where does the money come from? And therefore, what's the message? And one of the most common messages in misinformation, you take a topic that the public is interested in, you start running with it. You sound legit. You sound like you're really going to give them some solid information. And about two-thirds of the way down the road, you make a 90-degree right turn, and that's where you snap, and you give them the misinformation. There's an old saying, when you're dealing with misinformation, disinformation crews, and everything that goes with it, to catch fish, you need good bait. And so you have to have good information to lure the person in, to drag them down the road for a ways, and then turn that 90-degree angle and give them the misinformation that you want them to walk away with. So at any rate, I just wanted to include that because, of course, on a show like Coast to Coast, I didn't have time to go into that topic in that level of detail, because we move from topic to topic. You know, callers are calling in. But it's very important to understand that I use misinformation sites as educational tools for you, the public. So when you go to those sites, sure, you're going to be drawn in. Sure, you're going to be fooled for a while. But eventually, if you're smart, if you got your ears up like the deer in the woods, if you got your eyes open and you're getting an education, and that's what I want you to get, I don't want you to be stupid out there. I don't want you to be walking around in a zone where you do not understand how to recognize misinformation. So these sites are good. They have a benefit. Because once you get to them and you're fooled, you just got an education. Once you realize that you've been fooled, you just got an education. You've become smarter. You become smart in the ways of the world. And now you've also recognized one further thing. Why are people putting so much effort into disseminating false information, false leads, false right turns on the topic of Planet X? and the related topics? Well, it's very simple. Because if you were in the leadership position in the world, the bankers, the people that control the federal government of the U.S. and every other federal government around the world, if you were those people, what would be the one thing or the group of topics that you would not want the public to know about? And those are the topics that would take the public's mind, the public's vision, and turn it away from them. And now that's going to have to be a very big thing, because the public's very interested in jobs and the money situation, in the stock market. The stock market is crashing, and bailouts. 10,000 diversionary topics. But the one topic they don't want you to hear about, the one topic they don't want you to know the truth about, is the topic, the big topics, the things that will take the entire Earth population attention away from these false Earth leaders. And that, right in the middle, right smack dab in the middle of those, that group of topics, is the topic of Planet X. An object so big and powerful coming in unannounced from outside the solar system that's going to wreak havoc here. And guess what? Those leaders know better than you or me or everybody else put together that there's nothing they can do about it. And when you, the public, wakes up and you see one of those babies up in the sky rolling into the solar system, they're going to have their misinformation crews out there. That's just a little dirty snowball. Don't mind that. You can just see the Wizard of Oz standing behind his curtain pulling the strings. Don't mind that man over there. That's just don't mind the man behind the curtain. That's a dirty snowball up in the sky. It's not going to do anything, and all of the misinformation crews will be out there pounding that. You'll see it on the cover of Discover magazine, of all of the glossy magazines dealing with science. Oh, that's just a bigger than average dirty snowball. You know what I mean. But at any rate, see how important it is for the public to be fooled, to have all of these fooling mechanisms in place, so that when something big happens, you, the public, will not know about it. And of course, as long as they can keep people unemployed, running around like chickens with their head cut off, and trying to just maintain a life, pay the insurance bill, pay the house bill, pay the mortgage, try and get another mortgage, whatever they're doing, as long as they can keep these people running around without focusing on the real issues of the day, then they have accomplished their goal, because they have fooled the public, and now the public is going to be under their control. Okay, I want to follow up a little bit on the topic of last week when I talked about Venus coming into the solar system. The confusion of a lot of people who claim to be Planet X experts, and they talk about 3,600 years ago. The 3,600 year ago event was the Venus event. Venus came in. I described it in great detail. And by the way, if you miss these shows, excuse me, I always develop a frog right before this show in my throat. But if you miss any of the shows, remember, you can go to the archives. All of these radio shows are archived on my webpage, same page, jmccsci.com. Listen to last week's show, where I describe in great detail, I take the entire show, talk about the Venus event, Quetzalcoatl, the Mayans called him, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. And of course, every other civilization had a name for Venus, and that was the work that Velikovsky did, dealing with the changing of the calendars 3,600 years ago. So I wanted to add a little bit more to the topic. Last week I just concentrated on the topic of Venus being captured by Jupiter, eventually working its way into the solar system, encountering Mars, removing the atmosphere of Mars and its oceans. This was seen from Earth. This is historically documented. Then Venus the comet wound its way into the solar system, encountering Earth on two different occasions, 54 years apart. We know that from the Mayan Legends, and then eventually nestled into the orbit where it sits today. But I want to ask a more general scientific question. Now, Venus, the comet, as it was captured by Jupiter, was thrown into the inner solar system and was pretty much in the plane of the planets. Its orbit lay pretty much in the plane of the planets, and so it worked its way in. But what would happen, the more likely scenario, if an object, a big object like the nucleus of a new inbound planetary object being formed by a comet, these are the big ones, not the little comets like Halley's Comet, but the big ones that we rarely see in the solar system. What if Jupiter captured one and its orbit went up out of the plane of the planets? How would that object, now it's trying to work its way into the inner solar system, the tail drag is slowing it down, its orbit is falling in closer and closer to the sun over a very long period of time. But we got a little problem with this hypothetical new member of the solar system. Its orbit lays out of the plane of the planets. Not very neat. Let's just put it that way. What physical mechanism is used, what physical mechanism is in the design to bring that object into the plane of the solar system where all of the rest of the planets lie? And then that brings up another question. Why do all the planets we see now pretty much lie in one plane? That's defined by the orbit of Jupiter. Well, it's a very simple property and something that I had to answer in my original papers when I was at Cornell University. I was working through all of these problems, celestial mechanics, electromagnetism in the solar system, and the physics dealing with all of this. And this particular problem, of course, was one of the first ones to show its little face to me. And I had to solve it. I said, now how does this work? Well, what happens is as the object moves up above the plane of the planets in its orbit, it's sitting, it's moving up, and then it comes down, and then on another, about the other half of its orbit, it moves down below the plane of the planets. Well, it's a very simple gravitational tug. When the object is in its orbit above the plane of the planets, all of the planets, especially Jupiter, the big planet, is pulling down on it. Now, as it crosses through the ecliptic, as it moves around its orbit around the sun, as it moves down below the ecliptic, below the plane of the planets, all of the planets, including the big planet Jupiter, are pulling up on it. So it gets pulled down when it's above the plane of the planets, it gets pulled up when it's below the plane of the planets. So it's constantly being pulled into the plane of the planets. So over a long period of time, it would eventually be pulled into the plane of the planets. Its orbit would be brought into what we call the ecliptic. Actually, the ecliptic is the plane of Earth's orbit. And if I were going to come into a solar system as an alien, which I don't know if I'll be able to do that within my lifetime, if you came into a solar system, unbeknownst to you, you were just exploring it for the first time, you probably wouldn't pick one of the smaller planets like Earth to define the plane of the solar system as we do. The reason we do that is because we happen to live on planet Earth. So we define the plane of the planets relative to the orbit of Earth. But if you were to come into a solar system for the first time and start to chart out the orbits of the planets and the moons and the asteroids, etc., all of the objects in the solar system, you would probably pick the biggest planetary member, and in the case of our solar system, it would be Jupiter, to define the plane of the planets. And that's exactly what happens also physically. That's the object that's going to dominate and pull down on things that are above the solar system when they are moving up there, and then when things are down below the solar system, they'll be pulled up. That brings all of the objects into one plane. So it's a natural phenomena, it's a natural result of gravity. That's all. And gravity is the glue of the solar system. Electricity and magnetism come into play in very subtle ways, but gravity is the overall dominating force when we're dealing with celestial mechanics and the mechanics of objects moving through the solar system. So I just wanted to throw that in because last week that was a point that I left out because it would have complicated too much the lecture for last week dealing with the orbit of Venus. So at any rate, let's go back to this idea of an object coming into the solar system. First of all, will all the objects coming into the solar system affect Earth? The answer is no. In fact, in a direct sense, I'm talking about coming close with gravitational waves sufficient to create mountains to cause the tilt of our rotational direction to cause the sliding of the surface, the crust and the mantle of the Earth over the core. Would every Planet X-type object that comes into the solar system drastically affect us? And the answer is no. There are more subtle effects, what I call action at a distance, because these objects would, say, affect the sun. They would discharge the solar capacitor. We would have solar flares coming out of the sun. We would have electrical discharges, possibly between large comets and Earth, causing severe weather situations. So these actions at a distance could happen, but it's only when on those rare occasions these big objects really get close to Earth, that's when the severe damage happens. And if you look back through the history of Earth, there are probably about a dozen what we call mass extinctions, where literally almost everything on Earth was killed, that died in a massive single event, about a dozen of them throughout the history of Earth. And actually one of them was only a few thousand years ago. So you can imagine that there were times when Earth had, for example, the dinosaurs lived for, 180 million years, almost unaltered, with a tremendous amount of development going on. And all of a sudden, boom, that was it. The curtain down, lights out. The dinosaurs went away. And it appears now that as people study that dinosaur event, it was not an asteroid that collided with Earth that caused the damage. It was something else. Gee, I wonder if it could have been a passing large comet. One that could maybe come back in 50 or 100 million years. Maybe there's some pattern there. Maybe it was an object that just came through once, left, and will never come back again. We don't know. We don't have history of this. And so, as I said last week, it's very important to understand the history of all of these events, but we don't have the information. So that's why people who run around just talking about Planet X and Nibiru, that's a very singular individual event, and we don't really have a good handle on it. There's information that I developed as I researched into this and also looked at the fact that Harrington, who worked for the Naval Observatory, was looking to the south. He was looking from New Zealand. He was looking into the southern sky during the merry month of May, as I always call it, and early June. And that's where they were looking for one particular object. But of course, even back then, in the 1980s and early 1990 era, when Harrington was doing his work, it was about a 10-year period, he was contracted by NASA to search for Planet X. Literally, that was the name of the NASA-funded study that Harrington was working under as he was head of the Naval Observatory at that time. So, but even at that time, I don't think they had a real inkling that there were so many of these objects. That's what the important work that I did, and that's something that I have just been pounding on over the decades, And finally, NASA has picked up on it. They have satellites out there doing searches for these objects. And my understanding is that they have found literally thousands of large planetary objects on very obtuse orbits. In other words, orbits that are not nice and circular. They talk and they release information about what they call the Kuiper objects. They're about the size of Pluto, but they're in relatively safe orbits outside the orbit of Pluto, out in that region, maybe 1 to 2 orbital distances from the Sun as the orbit of Pluto. So there's about 40, and I think I mentioned this also on the Coast to Go show the other night, that if the whole reason for denouncing Pluto as a planet, removing it from the planet list, is because if they allowed Pluto to be a planet with its size and its orbit, all of a sudden we would have about 40 more planets. And that would bring up kind of an important question that they just didn't want to have to answer. How come we have 40 more planets all of a sudden? What's the story? We had 9, now there's 40. Now there's 49, there's 40 more. So there were 9, now there's 49. What's the deal, NASA? And then, of course, it'd bring up the question about Planet X. Couldn't there be a big one out there? Could it come into the solar system? Could it affect Earthlings? All of those questions would then be asked by the public. So what did the World Astronomical Community vote for? Actually, they didn't even vote for it. It was kind of a mandate that came from certain overpowering groups within the Astronomical International Community to remove Pluto as a planet. And actually, as I recall, the vote was very much in favor of leaving Pluto as a planet. But as I said, that brings up a big conundrum, a big problem for the astronomy community, because all of a sudden, you've got 40 more planets. And couldn't there be a big one out there? That's something they simply didn't want to have to discuss. And where did the mandate for that come from? It wasn't a science issue. Now let's get to the basis. Remember, who butters their bread? Who pays the scientists? Where do they get their money? All of them work for government agencies. I go to meetings all over the world. I deal with these people. They stand there and they all get a paycheck. Where does that paycheck come from? From a university. Where does the university get the money for them? From the government. All of it comes funneling through one source. Where does the government get their money? From the bankers. Who wants to stay in control? The bankers. You start to see the pattern. You start to understand, why was Pluto denounced as a planet? Very simply, because that was a topic that was central to them keeping power. If Pluto were allowed to remain as a planet, then there would be a tremendous number of questions coming from the average person on the street. Okay, so let me go on to another topic somewhat related. So what is the absolute central core lesson from Planet X that relates to people? Most of us think, well, gee, I got to prepare, I got to get a water filter, I got to get food stored up, I want to really be ready. Should I dig a cave? Should I find a cave system to live in? On and on. The central, actually, that's all good because you want to be prepared, whether there's a worldwide drought, a weather scenario, whether a volcano goes off and gives us a mini winter, whether we get hit by a solar flare and knocks out the electrical grid. Preparation is the same for all of these. Just be prepared to take care of yourself. Imagine the people in American Samoa or Indonesia, where the bridges are out and these people have to live out there for weeks and weeks without any aid coming at all. Those people are probably far better prepared to exist than the Americans or Europeans who depend on the grid every day. But at any rate, the point, getting back to the main point, the central point of the whole idea about Planet X is that we have to, as a civilization, move into outer space, en masse. Not one guy going to the moon in 20 years, not the new NASA pseudo Apollo program, or maybe go send one guy to Mars in 30 years. Just imagine this, from 1965 to about 2035, which is the lifespan of the past, present, and future NASA, no progress has been made in space relative to getting the population in space in large numbers. It's a onesie, twosie, send up a guy, wait 6 months, send up the shuttle. Now we have to wait for a new rocket program to develop so that they can maybe send an astronaut to the moon like they did allegedly in 1969. But what a worthless project. What is that going to accomplish? Well, the main thing it's going to accomplish, it's going to spend a lot of money and it's going to divert a lot of resources so that you, the public, will not get into space. I have to take a break and take a sip of water. I'll be right back. Thank you. Appreciate. By the way, that's filtered water from my Dalton water filter. I usually mix a little bit of juice in it, not orange juice, but like a grape juice, something like that, and then a full glass of water. Have that handy for my show or if I'm doing a show as a guest. But yeah, that's the main educational result of Planet X. Now, let's take the Colburn. Remember when the Colburn first came out, I introduced that to the public with the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. That book I introduced on the Coast to Coast show one night many years ago. And that it was the first time the public had seen or heard of the Colburn. Well, it didn't take long for the disinformation crew to try and get a hold of that book and change it, alter it, turn it into something goofy, try and associate it with the Mayan calendar in 2012 and everything else in the kitchen sink. Well, why would that happen? Well, it's just like everything else. They don't want the public to really understand the true nature of the Colburn. The true nature of the Colburn is to teach you one very simple thing. It starts out by talking about the demise of man and then the rebirth of man due to the great comets. The great comets. They don't look like a big orange ball like you'll see on the cover of the misinformation Colburn. And by the way, the only true place to get a Colburn is chaldeantrust.org. You can find the link on my webpage. Big, beautiful, well, just beautifully bound book. But it starts out by talking about the great comets of old, the Planet X's. Planet X is not going to be a big orange ball in the sky. It's going to be a large raging comet. And that's the very most important point that you will learn in the Colburn. In addition to all of the great information, the Colburn is a collection of books that have been handed down through the ages from the personal library of Joseph of Arimathea, who was Christ's great uncle. But at any rate, I'm not going to go into that too much, but let's go back to something that happened this last week. Obama, our illustrious president, cut NASA funding. Now, we all knew this was going to happen. Is it good? Is it bad? Of course, NASA's like, oh, gee, now we have to try and accomplish our goals, but with less funding. Let me tell you something, everybody. This is a giant dog and pony show. What happens, and this has been going on for the last 40 years or 50 years, whatever you want to call it, since NASA's been around, the president or Congress cuts NASA funding. Well, gee, what happens then? NASA says, well, it's going to take us longer to do and accomplish what we're going to do. So then if we fail, if we have any failures, we can blame it on low funding. But see, the key here is they're still going to do the ridiculous moon program, sending one guy to the moon in 30 years. It's now going to take them longer. Well, isn't that swell? Obama cuts their funding. It's going to take longer, but they're still going to do the same program. While other countries are going to be going to the moon, they're going to be setting up colonies. I've always said that China is has far more ability to go to space because they have a society. It's not based on corporate profits. In the NASA program, there have been huge corporate profits made in the space program. That's one of the first things everybody learned. Hey, you can make money on this deal. The government gives us money to NASA. NASA gives it to us. We make money. Great for profits, corporate profits. Lots of big profit there. But the end result is there's really no space program. That's not how you would design a space program if you really wanted to go to space and you really wanted to get the public into space. Let me take another example. Every place on the internet now, you are going to find prizes. And of course, the X Prize was a great prize. excuse me, I hope my voice lasts here. The X Prize that Bert Rutan won to go into outer space with his spaceship won, it was a tremendous prize, and it really showed great innovation. But when that aircraft went off the runway that day under the white night, was launched, went into low Earth orbit, and came back, there were a lot of military observers out there, and let me tell you something, they did not like it at all. They did not want to see this, because what it showed is a guy with innovation like Bert Rutan, some funding that came from a guy like Paul Allen, all of a sudden could go into space easily, without effort, and didn't need this giant rocket system. So that's going to lead into the very next topic. But now, all I'm saying is these prizes that you see are not to cause innovation to go into space. They are meant in a very subtle way to prevent people from getting into space, because you see all of the efforts that are being made follow the NASA lead. I just want to recount something. I got an email from a person, a fan listener this past week, and here's what it said. I'm looking into some information that makes it hard for me to agree with a statement that satellites are too heavy for plane-based delivery systems. Talked about a telecom satellite that weighed 6,700 kilograms, while the payload stats for a DC-10 aircraft, which is, of course, a commercial aircraft, operating empty weight, 120,000 kilograms, maximum takeoff weight, 259,000 kilograms. So there you're dealing with 130,000 kilograms of takeoff weight carrying capacity in a DC-10, which by today's standards is relatively small. And so now you're comparing that to a measly 6,700 kilogram payload for a satellite. What's the problem? And that's what this person is asking me. So here's my answer. Now let me explain. To go from a runway into space, that's taking off with an airplane. You go up till you get out of the air about 4 or 5 miles up, and then you use rockets to go the rest of the way into space. You save a tremendous amount of weight because of the lift of the wings. And so here's my response. And of course, NASA keeps building rockets, the ones that you see anyway, as their main way to get into space. So here's my response to the person asking about the DC-10, the ability to take payloads into space. Here's my answer. I say, runway to space has always been the only way to go. A rocket filled with 3 million pounds of fuel, well, you are trying to launch 3 million pounds with a small payload. As the payload gets bigger by 1 pound, now you need to add a lot more fuel for that extra pound of payload. But now you need more fuel to lift the extra fuel. This is called the rocket problem and is, of course, well known by everybody in the industry, but government mandates and policies state that we are developing bigger rockets. Maximum payload for a rocket from Earth gravity is about the size of the Saturn V rocket, with lift of wings being about 10 times what you get. This is an advantage you get from the airfoil from wings. You get down to the weight of an airplane, and with lighter materials, you can get even more advantage. any airframe capable of going to 40,000 feet, which is your standard airliner, is also pressure capable of going into space, since the pressure differential is only about 14 pounds per square inch. So where's the problem? The problem is, if you let airplanes go into space, then anyone could easily get into space. NASA's charter is not to forge frontiers and get us into space, as with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. It is to keep you from getting into space and make it look as if it's so difficult that only a national program with a monopoly like NASA could get you there. Look at all the clowns that are trying to enter these prize contests, all trying to follow the good old NASA lead. The prizes are not to help get us into space, but to sort out anyone who may have a real innovative idea and squelch it before it grows. Enough said. That was my response. And then here was the response of the person writing back to me. He said, "That's the kind of insight that most people will never be able to arrive at on their own. And furthermore, when it is broken down for them in plain English, like what you do, even then it is not accepted out of the internal unspoken belief that the planet is run by basically good leaders. People are emotionally invested in this worldview to the point that they will self-edit and reject any idea that doesn't fit the model. There are many examples of fictional authors and movie producers who portray this dilemma. I constantly refer to The Matrix, The Truman Show, or The Wizard of Oz to give common reference points. In any case, as the arc of so-called civilization begins to descend into Mad Max conditions, this whole discussion becomes moot as human existence gets reduced to complete focus on the demands of physical survival." In other words, we're doomed to go back to the cave ages because ultimately we are not doing what Planet X, the whole topic of Planet X and the many Planet X objects, the entire lesson is that we have limited resources. We have limited time. We have limited talent. And there's one thing that's going to benefit mankind in this entire scenario, and that is to get in mass large populations of people into outer space. And you can now see that the one charter for NASA, as I said, is not to get us into space. It's to give us that illusion that there's a space program going on and that somehow we are entering the final frontier. The goal of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, is not public safety. If that were the case, why aren't they monitoring surfboarders out in the ocean? That's one of the most dangerous things you can do. Jump on a board and surf on a 60-foot wave? I'd call that pretty dangerous. I don't see the FAA out there monitoring that or any other type of activity. No, they're not interested in safety. They are interested in preventing the public, you the public, from getting into space. Now, I'm talking the surfboard analogy, of course, is a little far-fetched because the FAA does not regulate surfboards. It's not in their jurisdiction. But I think the point is that when it comes to going into space, the FAA has created so much red tape that it's simply to prevent people from going into outer space. If they were so worried about safety, why aren't they governing what NASA does? They don't do anything. NASA has free rein to do whatever it wants, develop whatever it wants, and go fly around with whatever it wants. The FAA is not interested in safety. In fact, I don't know if you saw this recently. I forgot to announce it on the show, but NASA released a huge volume of ionic metallic material up in the upper atmosphere, and people saw the glowing effect of this, but that's experimental, and I don't believe it had any detrimental effect to the population on Earth. But the point is, nobody came and asked me if that was a good idea and should NASA be allowed to do it. I don't know if anybody out there, did anybody come to your door and knock on it and say, gee, NASA's going to do this, Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that's a bad idea? I don't recall anybody asking me. And so at any rate, the point is that if you try to develop a space program in your garage or in your barn, as the movie portrayed, somebody would come in, knock on your door and say, you can't do that. Well, gee, what is the difference here? Where is the difference? Well, the difference is that this official space program, the NASA space program, that comes out of everybody's tax money, supposedly, at any rate, that is not meant to be a space program. It's a facade. It's a smokescreen. It's meant to prevent the public from getting to space. Let's look at some of the other irresponsible things that NASA has done. I've talked about this before. The space junk in outer space. Irresponsible space exploration. Contamination of the moon, Mars, and other planets with space probes that go in and land on these planets with bacteria from Earth on them. How absolutely irresponsible. This all started in Antarctica when scientists could go down there and without decontaminating their equipment first, could go into these pristine areas. Now we have NASA sending space probes into planets, moons of the solar system, without decontaminating them first. So now, when the public, if we ever do get into space with private space programs, we have to contend with space junk. Thousands and tens of thousands of pieces of junk floating around up there that have residue from NASA space launches and from the Russian space program, etc. Also, China just blew up a satellite as a test. 25,000 pieces of junk floating around up there from that little experiment. So at any rate, the issue of Planet X, what's the main thing that we have to learn from this idea that big objects can come into the solar system, wreak havoc with the solar system, and leave us devastated? Each time are we meant to go back to the cave ages and come crawling out till the next one comes rolling through? Absolutely not. The main issue is to garner resources, bring the level of expertise together to get into outer space on a massive scale, and these designs exist. I have my own. I've seen designs from other people. There are many people working in ecosystems that are very much contribute to this idea of a massive population center in outer space where it's free to move around away from devastation and exist and save basically the human race. What happens if we don't learn that lesson from the topic of Planet X? Well, it's very simple. It may not be this year, it may not be next year, it may not be in 100 years, or it may not be in 10,000 years, but eventually, boom, this planet and its population is going back to the cave ages, if they survive at all. We were very lucky 3,600 years ago or 10,000 years ago, whenever that Venus event happened, we were extremely lucky to survive as a human race, as a population. So what are we going to do for the next one? We've gone thousands of years waiting for the next one without accomplishing the real goal. Once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.